I cover a large variety of topics from the realms of sustainability. And ultimately, drugs are not sustainable. Just ask Lance Armstrong. Having worked operations for international professional cycling races, being in that position, I just couldn't buy into Lance's fierce stance about not doping. Here is an interview I did with London Times sports editor David Walsh back in 2007, when David had just written From Lance to Landis. As the 2021 Tour de France gets started this year, I thought this might be an interesting look and listen into hindsight. I'm Robin. Stay tuned.
David, welcome.
Yeah, I'm pleased to be here.
Now, can you describe what it has been like for a clean athlete to compete with an EPO user? Because using drugs in competition oftentimes present a physical risk for the user, but little known to the public are the passive risks.
Oh, yes. I mean, we're talking about athletes who don't use drugs and find themselves in a race where they're competing against people who do use drugs. Those athletes will find themselves, the clean guys, pushing their bodies to very extreme lengths in order to keep up with the guys who are doped. And of course, you know, athletes are very competitive people, and when they ride clean, they may suspect that the guy riding next to them is doping, but that athlete can't countenance the idea that his rival has an unfair advantage. So he convinces himself that it's a sort of level playing field and that all he's got to do is work harder, push his body more. And the guy who's clean, because he's pushing himself beyond the natural boundaries, is actually more of a risk to himself and doing more damage to his body than the guy who's doping alongside of him, because the guy who's doping has got this extra fuel and he can still ride within himself and ride at a very high speed. So, you know, in France for the last number of years, they've been talking about the effects of passive doping, where you don't dope, but you suffer some pretty serious consequences in terms of your body breaking down because you're trying to compete with those who do dope.
And, of course, one of the benefits of doing the EPO drug, for instance, is the fact that your body recovers at a much more quick rate.
That's right. And Robin, partly the reason it recovers at a faster rate is because it doesn't get as worn down in the first place. Because, as I say, you're operating or you're being driven by a superior fuel, you know, the kind of supercharged fuel. So your body is working more efficiently, and in a less taxing and in a less damaging way. You know, the cell destruction that you get when you make strenuous efforts in any kind of athletic discipline, that isn't as great if your body isn't being pushed to the same extent. And with this supercharged fuel, it's not.
Now, what was your motive in writing From Lance to Landis? Obviously, it's not just an American problem.
Oh, no, it's absolutely not. And certainly the problem didn't originate in America. I mean, if you went back to the old 7-Eleven team, which was one of the first U.S. cycling teams to go to Europe and compete on the superior. I mean, the European circuit is the world's number one circuit for professional riders. That's where you go if you want to be a star in professional cycling, because, you know, I mean, professional cycling's DNA is rooted in countries like France, Italy, Spain, Belgium, Holland, Germany, places like that. So if you were an American, you know, and very talented, you had to go to Europe to prove how good you were, because that was the kind of, you know, category one circuit for professional cyclists. And the first American teams who went knew nothing about doping or very little about doping, and certainly had no desire to dope. But the teams that succeeded, that original team, 7-Eleven, Motorola came next. And I would regard Motorola, you know, the second great American team to operate in Europe. They were the first to kind of discover that if you didn't dope, you were at a serious disadvantage. And they came to a crossroads in their kind of evolution as a team. And the Motorola team decided it was never going to achieve the results that the riders felt entitled to unless they got on the doping bandwagon and joined their European, not all of them, but joined a number of their European counterparts in doping. and the Motorola team, you know, from the research that I have done and the people I have spoken to, certainly began a doping program in the mid-90s.
Can we go back in history for the Tour de France? What was EPO, a drug that just was able to make such a drastic shift in someone's ability to ride? Or has there been doping all along, but it just hasn't been as either relevant or as potent?
He certainly, I mean, it was always, the doping problem has always been relevant, because if people cheat, that's relevant, and they've got an unfair advantage over those who play by the rules. So it's always been relevant, but there was a time when the drugs that they used were drugs like cortisone, important drugs that did make a difference, but didn't always make a decisive difference. And if you were very talented and you were clean, back, say, in the mid-80s, you definitely could compete and could win. And then EPO came along in the late 80s, early 90s, and it was a drug that just, you know, unfortunately, in some respects, from the whole kind of sports person's point of view, it was just too good as a drug in terms of how it enhanced performance. Because what EPO did was it basically changed the composition of your blood, and it gave you all these extra red cells. And as we know, the red cells transport the oxygen to the muscles, and the more fuel that the muscles get, the more work they can do. And EPO increased that fuel. I mean, consider it like this. One of the reasons that small guys used to always be very good in the Tour de France mountain stages. I mean, when I was in my early days, in the early 80s, covering the Tour de France, we used to watch people like Lucho Herrera, who couldn't have been more than 8.5 stones, winning these epic mountain stages of the Tour de France.
Can you translate 8.5 stones? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sorry, I mean, kilos, pounds. I mean, we're talking about guys who were, you know, maybe 110 pounds.
Okay, thank you.
You know, guys who were maybe 115, 120 pounds, you know, very light, slightly built athletes. I mean, guys who were bigger than jockeys, you know, but not much bigger than jockeys. And they were some of the most brilliant mountain riders, and the Colombians were just in a class of their own, and they tended, a lot of them tended to be slightly built men. And the reason why they had an advantage was that they just had, they had less weight to transport up that mountain, and they had the endurance and they had the talent, and they were brilliant. And the big guys couldn't do it because the laws of gravity were against them. And one of the reasons that was the case was that they just couldn't get enough, you know, oxygen to their muscles. Impossible. And suddenly when EPO came along, that changed. And suddenly we had big guys winning the Tour de France. Miguel Indurain, the great Spanish rider who won 5 times. I mean, he was a big man. He was a man that you just didn't expect would ever be able to get over the big mountains of the Tour de France. But maybe, you know, more pertinently, all the small guys that used to be so good in the mountains, when EPO came along, they lost their advantage. And we never had, virtually never had, Colombians winning big stages of the Tour de France in the late 90s or in the mid-90s after EPO came along. It was a drug that people couldn't believe that a new drug could come along and have such an impact. One of the most kind of, I suppose, experienced or seasoned commentators on the whole drug problem was a guy called Willie Vogt, who worked basically for 30 years in cycling teams as a dispenser of doping products. He was called a soigneur, as in carer, and they were the guys who were given the responsibility or given the job of getting the drugs and administering the drugs. And Willie Vogt had a way of putting it. He used to say the old drugs like, you know, cortisone, and in the early days, you know, they used amphetamines and stimulants of different sorts. Those kind of drugs, he said, allowed a man to kind of find the best of himself. EPO came along and it allowed a man to become a different man. It actually created a new athlete, quite unrelated to the guy who existed in the first place.
Now, going back to the motive, for instance, Marion Jones, as you know, is a track star here in the United States, and she just made a very public apology for drug use and has returned her Olympic medals. What ultimate effect do you think this has? I mean, what effect did you want to have from writing your book and having this information come out?
Yeah, I wanted people to see. I have to be dead honest about this. I wanted people to see that some of the so-called icons in our society, some of the so-called superstars, when you investigate them, they're not what the media and what they themselves and their sponsors and their advertisers have presented them to be. They're not the role models. They're not the icons that people, you know, believe they are. And I don't think somebody who has cheated to achieve their gains, and we're talking multi-million dollar gains here, I don't think we should respect those people. I'm glad that Marion Jones came out and made her admission. I must say I never was a believer in Marion Jones. I mean, I liked her as a woman. She always seemed like a really nice person. And in some respects, she was a victim of the whole pervasive kind of doping that we get in elite sport. And you could say that, well, if everybody else was doing it, but everybody else wasn't doing it. And in no sport should we ever, it's far too easy to say, if they're all doing it, what's the difference? Because my answer to that is, well, what about the good people, the moral people, who decided at an earlier stage, I'm not going to achieve in this sport because you do have to cheat to win. I'm not prepared to cheat. And of course, we never know about them because they never got beyond, you know, being in the, you know, they never got into the world top 10. And they never were superstars. So therefore, they're kind of, in a way, anonymous victims. But there are plenty of anonymous victims because there are lots of people who want to do sport fairly because their love of sport is such that, you know, part of their love of sport is that it's a very healthy thing to be doing. And you shouldn't have to be injecting yourself to do it.
Yes.
And I wanted people to see that, you know, some of our superstars, you know, if a superstar is a person that we should want to emulate, is a person that we should admire, well, then they're not superstars. And I did want to write also in my book about some of the victims, some of the people who had great athletic talent, great integrity, great dedication, all of that stuff. The one thing they didn't have was that moral ambivalence to the doping question. And they weren't prepared to dope, and they have suffered. And I've written about some of these people in my book. And in a way, if I were dedicating the book to anybody, I think maybe, you know, that the people I would dedicate it to are all the people who were dedicated to doing it clean.
It's also an interesting point, and an important one, I believe, that it becomes a financial issue. It was not cheap to do all this doping. So if you were a very good writer, but you didn't quite have the funds behind you, you were stuck also.
That's right. There's no question about that. I mean, during the kind of, you know, the kind of peak days, and I'm not saying the doping problem in cycling is gone. Clearly, it's not. We had loads of doping in this year's Tour de France, and we had, you know, the leader in the yellow jersey being basically removed from the race for doping, and it being, you know, and one of the big favorites being found to dope as well. So it's still a big problem. But back in the mid-90s, we used to talk about, for example, we would talk about 1996 as being Cecchini's year. And you know, a person coming in from the outside will say, oh, you know, what kind of a rider was Cecchini? He wasn't a rider. He was a doctor, Luigi Cecchini. And it was his year because all his riders won that year, which in the peloton was translated as he got the cocktail of drugs right that year. He got an advantage on all the other doctors, and all of his guys won all of the big races. And, you know, that's how sick the environment had become, that the most influential person in terms of deciding who won and who lost the race was not the athlete himself, but his doctor. And, of course, these guys, within their world, are regarded as superstars. I mean, Lance Armstrong's doctor had a nickname, the Legend, they called him. Mm-hmm. Now, that's Michele Ferrari. And these guys became the biggest guys in the sport in some respects, and they charged enormous fees. I mean, the feeling is that... I spoke to a rider who wouldn't go to Ferrari because Ferrari just cost too much. Like something like 20% of all you won went to your doctor. And I mean, that kind of, you know, is that the sports society we want? Is that the kind of stuff, you know, that if we were fortunate enough to have children who were incredibly talented in sport, Do we want them going off, having to find the best doctor, then having to turn over 20% of their their earnings to their doctor? And you know, if I've kind of fought this fight, it's for all of these reasons.
I would much rather see someone like Ekimov get the 20% of the person he's riding for. I mean, there are so many unknown heroes in cycling.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, yes, that's absolutely true. The team rider should get it. But I mean, and the thing about cycling is that one of the reasons we're attracted to it as a sport, and I certainly am attracted to it, is that it's just such a healthy thing to do, to get on your bike and to ride uphill and to ride downhill and to travel across the countryside on your bike has to be one of the most wonderful things to do. Get that wind on your face, get the, you know, the sense of gliding over the road when you're fit and well. Wonderful. For such a beautiful pastime activity, competitive sport, to be kind of besmirched by this kind of doping phenomenon has been one of the kind of sporting, I'm reluctant to use the word tragedies, but one of the sporting travesties of the kind of 20th century and early 21st century.
Now, many will argue that because of the amounts of money involved, there's no hope for professional cycling in regards to doping anymore.
What I would say to that is, you know, we're not going to stop people, you know, ending up with cancer as an illness, but we keep fighting it. And this is a cancer in sport.
Beautifully said. You know, I'm wondering how difficult it was to get people to come forward. It's not easy toppling an American icon. Many people want to hold on to the hero.
Yes, they do, you know. And on that question, people regard this as quite a cynical thing to say, and I don't see it as cynical. I see it in a kind of, it's a hard thing to say, but I'll say it. I think it was Galileo who once said, in a kind of a quote from Galileo, was that God saved a country that has no heroes. And a second voice says, no, God saved a country that needs heroes. And there is something vulnerable about people who need heroes. And it's very hard to say to a kid that you can't have an icon, or you shouldn't trust what you see. But it's better to say that than to say to the kid, this guy is somebody you should totally admire, when you know that that person is somebody they shouldn't admire. You know, the harsh thing is the best thing in this case. We only admire people if they deserve our admiration.
Now, I'm not trying to argue the fact that drug use has not played a huge part in cycling and other sports, as we just brought up with Marion Jones. But I also want to raise the, however naive, question of the testing and the possibility of individuals having different reactions to tests and supplement use that perhaps is herbal in essence or something like that. Is it just a flat-out black-and-white test?
No, I mean, you're absolutely justified in your question, and I'm sure there are situations where mistakes have been made in laboratories. I'm sure that's happened. I would also say that probably the most eminent anti-doping tester that the U.S. has produced is Professor Don Catlin, formerly at UCLA. And Don Catlin once said in an interview that, of all the testing I have done in sport, looking for performance-enhancing drugs, for every negative I find, I know that I am finding 14. For every positive that I find, I know that I am finding 14 false negatives. In other words, for every person I say is guilty, I am letting off 14 that I know are guilty but can't prove are guilty. So when we get upset about the I would say rare case of making a mistake at a lab, remember that there's, according to one of the world's great experts, Don Catlin, 14 times that many people are escaping because the system isn't good enough. And I would say, you know, and they're the people who, you know, whatever it is, the blood parameters that Don Kaplan sees, he sees the effects of the doping. He knows this person is doped. But because they've been using a masking agent, he doesn't know, or because sometimes the effects of the doping are clear in one's blood or in one's urine. But the actual substance they took to make those effects has disappeared. So the scientist knows this person has doped, but doesn't have the actual proof. And so that's one thing I would say. And let's look for a second and get more specific in our example here. You take Floyd Landis, who's now appealed his case. He won the Tour de France, tested positive for testosterone. Synthetic testosterone was found in a number of his samples. He said it's lab error. He appealed to United States Anti-Doping Agency. His appeal was rejected on a 2-1 vote. He's now taking this to CAS. Now, Floyd makes some very good points about sloppy work at the lab. And the lab says we may have had some sloppy work here, but we still have, I think it's 5 of his samples containing synthetic testosterone. How do you explain that? And if Floyd wanted me on his side, he would have been consistent in his answers to questions when this first came up. Before he tested positive, on the 2006 Tour de France, which was the one that Floyd won, he was asked about guys who were kicked out of the race because they were linked with very good evidence to a major blood doping ring or basically corruption case in Madrid in Spain. Floyd was persistently asked about these guys because Floyd was winning the 2006 Tour de France or up there right with the leaders. He was always being asked about the guys who were kicked out because they were a number of the favorites. And Floyd could have said, well, if these guys are involved in a doping ring, they have no place in our sport, and I'm delighted they were kicked out of the race. What Floyd said was he was sorry they weren't there, and that was all he would say. Now, to me, if you're anti-doping, you're anti-guys who are doping. And that was a key moment in terms of defining Floyd Landis' attitude.
Right. I mean, I would have to say that I can see where his empathy would come from because of the pressure at that level of the sport. I'm not condoning it at all, but I can certainly understand his sentiment at that point in time.
Yeah, well, I mean, my feeling is that if I'm riding clean, I don't want to be screwed by people who are doping. And the allegation from the organizers was that these guys who were kicked out of the race, that they had files which said these people were blood doping. There was blood in Spain that had been seized by the police. What the authorities said was, all you've got to do is give a DNA sample, and if the blood is not yours, you're in the race. And these guys refused to give that sample. So therefore, to me, that was an admission of guilt. They subsequently have been proven to have been involved in this. So Floyd sees all of this happening, and he regrets they're not in the race and has no hint of condemnation.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, if you're riding clean and the money is being taken from your pocket,
yes,
by people who are cheating, you feel anger towards those guys. There was an English cyclist asked about the same guys, Bradley Wiggins. He said, good riddance, we need these guys out of our sport.
Well, we had the first tour of Missouri this year in the United States, as I'm sure you're aware of.
Yes.
And it happened in September, and it was post all of the hoopla, so to speak, that went on in the Tour de France this year. And I really saw it as a wonderful opportunity. It's like, here is a good chance. It seems like the let's sweep it under the carpet mentality is gone. And like you said before, let's get rid of the cancer however we can. Let's keep trying.
Yes.
Now, I know for 2008, the Tour de France course has been changed, and they're not guaranteeing entry for any team as they've done in the past. And I'm wondering if you could explain why you think this was done and what will be the outcome of that.
It's going to be very interesting because, you've got this, for example, you've got this team that is sponsored from Kazakhstan called Astana. They had a number of riders last year who were proven positive, kicked out of the Tour de France, other riders who tested positive. And you would have said this team has definitely been involved in doping for sure, some of its riders at least. Now, one of the new bosses of this team is Johan Bernil, the former boss of the U.S. Postal Team and the boss of the Discovery Team, Lance Armstrong's director sportif for every time that Lance won the Tour. Bernil's rider, Alberto Contador, he won the Tour de France this year. Now, Contador has also been linked with this blood doping ring in Spain. He says he's not involved. The police say, well, no, he's not really, or the Spanish sports minister says he's not involved, but there are extensive documents that link him to it. So it's up in the air. But anyway, you've got this Astana team. Now, are the Tour de France going to allow the Astana team into the race? Because it's got a lot of kind of, it's just got a lot of suspicion about it from the people who are involved. And that's going to be very interesting. But the Tour de France, they understand that they have one of the world's great sporting events. I would argue the Tour de France is the world's greatest, again, of international annual sports event. I'm sure lots of my US friends would say Super Bowl is, but I mean, we could argue about that. But I do believe the Tour de France is a fantastic, epic event. And we don't really have a lot of epics in sport anymore, but this is a 3.5-week race, you know, that generally runs kind of, you know, around a very big and beautiful European country called France. And it's got fantastic tradition going since 1903. And it actually doesn't matter that much who starts out in that race. By the end of the race, the winner is going to be acclaimed, because it's the race that makes the rider, not the rider who makes the Tour de France. In other words, if Lance Armstrong had never come along, the Tour de France was still a monumental event. And I think the organizers understand that. And they understand now that the biggest thing they can do for their race is to get it clean. And that's going to be extremely difficult. They know that. But I think they are pretty determined to do it. And I think they're determined to take some pretty serious measures. They're now talking about a kind of a biological passport, saying that they're going to blood test people early in the season, and they're going to be continually blood testing. They will establish kind of normal blood parameters for all these people and for all the athletes. And if any of them then deviate from that, they will not be allowed to ride the Tour de France. And that's the kind of thing we do need. And it needs to be monitored rigorously and aggressively. And people will talk about an invasion of human rights. They will talk about riders being hassled and all of that. But the point is, it is the athletes who have doped, and it is the doping that has done huge damage to the Tour de France. And the people who organized the Tour de France and the stakeholders in the race, and that includes, you know, the public as well as the actual people who control the company that runs it. We have a right to say, we don't care what it takes, we demand that this race produces fair competition and credible competition.
Yes, now we have Slipstream, powered by Chipotle. They do a weekly dope testing. Do you think this will make them a strong candidate for the Tour de France next year?
Yes, it will. There's no question that, Jonathan Vauters, who's the creator of the Slipstream team, Jonathan, I know, has met the Tour de France organizers, and they've been very impressed by what he's trying to do. And I think they're going to look very favorably on Jonathan's team when it comes to deciding who rides next year's Tour de France. And I think it's right. I mean, Jonathan Vauters rode in the U.S. postal team, and he was pretty determined when he left that team that he would never replicate the practices that he saw in that team.
Is there any really most outrageous accusation that's been hurled at you as a result of riding from Lance to Landis?
Loads of stuff has been thrown at me. Mostly it has to be said by Lance Armstrong and the people immediately around him. There was a comment given by Lance to NPR, National Public Radio, in the US. They asked him for a comment about something that was in Lance to Landis. And he said, look, this is a guy who's been sacked by the Sunday Times in London. Now, I took a year and 8 months. I left the newspaper as chief sports writer. I said I wanted to go away and write some books. They kept my job open for 1 year and 8 months. I returned at the beginning of this month, October. I'm back as chief sports writer.
London Times sports editor David Walsh from an interview back in 2007. For anything we do here on Tributaries, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are on your favorite platforms. And I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.